Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts, written with his friend Rob Ritchie. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
My pleasure, Ian.
And just a week ago, Time magazine had a cover story saying, captioned boldly, "The Decline and Fall of Europe." So last time I checked, that Europeans weren't doing so badly. I know there's been a lot of concern in the last few months about the debt contagion in the south with Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and I guess to the West Ireland. Since that cover came out, it seems like things have settled down. So I wanted to get you to address that disconnect between the apocalyptic sense that Europe's finished and the fact that it seems to be business as usual.
Yeah, I mean, this is a long pattern of American journalism. Magazines like Time, Newsweek, as well as the New York Times, Washington Post, for years. I mean, I have in my book Europe's Promise, I have a whole bunch of headlines I collected from the 1990s and the early 2000s, in which they predicted the decline and fall of Europe. In fact, Fareed Zakaria in February 2006 had an editorial in the Washington Post, and what was the title of that editorial? The Decline and Fall of Europe. So it seems that Europe has declined and fallen quite a few times over the last couple of decades, according to American media outlets, and yet there's Europe still with, you know, everyone in Europe, even in a place like Greece, has health care. People have retirement pensions. People have more vacation, paid sick leave, paid parental leave after they have a child. These things have not gone away in Europe just because Europe is having some economic difficulties in some of the southern countries like Portugal, Greece, and Spain, and Ireland. And in fact, I wrote an article not that long ago saying that, you know, if you look at the rest of Europe, if people weren't so obsessed on the so-called pigs, you actually find that Europe is doing quite well. 14 of the 23 European countries that are members of the OECD, and I use their unemployment rates because they have harmonized rates, but 14 of the 23 European countries in the OECD have lower unemployment rates than the United States does.
And, of course, Stephen Hill, there's no mention of what you were just saying in our press, not even next door where in Canada they have health care. Is there a sense and that the Canadians next door have a higher standard of living, we're more or less told that these people are suffering.
But I think at this point it's comparing apples and oranges. The European system is just so different from the American system that, you know, what is in fact austerity here doesn't have the same effect there. And the reason why is because Europe has basically, they have what I call social capitalism, and I compare that to what we have, which is Wall Street capitalism. And social capitalism is better at sharing the wealth and sharing the prosperity so that more people benefit from the wealth of your society. And it's also better at spreading the pain around when you have economic downtime. So, I mean, nations being in debt, not paying their bills and such is an issue that has to be addressed at some point. The question is, do you do it in the short term or in the long term? And Europe is, you know, for many of the countries, they're saying, we're going to address this debt now because we're able to deal with the pain of this economic downturn in a place like Germany, where the unemployment rate now is actually lower than it was before the economic crisis hit us in 2008. So they're now addressing their debt issues, but of course it's being termed as austerity, and yet in Germany, you know, people have health care. You're not seeing the cutbacks like they're proposing in Medicare and Social Security. They're able to deal with their debt without having to resort to these drastic means. In the U.S., our economy, our Wall Street capitalism, is basically a trickle-down economy. it's not an economy that has the institutions and values to allow us to spread both the prosperity around in the good years or the pain in the bad years. Instead, all the money goes into the pockets of the wealthy. I mean, my latest stand you on your toes factoid is the 400 wealthiest Americans now have $1.4 trillion in wealth, which is as much as the entire economy of the country of India with a billion people. We're talking about vast inequality here in the United States that's just gotten greater as a result of this economic collapse. And in addition, when you look at, well, where do we spend our wealth? There's two things that don't get discussed very much that stand out if you're objective and look at it, say, from the planet Mars. We spend a huge amount of money on our military budget that Europeans and others, Japan and other countries don't spend, that we can't afford anymore, and we spend twice as much money per capita on health care as all these other countries. And those two things over time are going to bankrupt our country. And so when you talk about should we have stimulus or austerity, and some people like Paul Krugman has said we need more stimulus, which in a way we do, but even more than more stimulus, we're already getting all sorts of stimulus from our ongoing spending in the military budget. We're spending trillions of dollars to keep 700 bases going around the world. We're spending trillions of dollars to employ soldiers that are spending money in other people's economies instead of here. We're not spending that money instead on infrastructure upkeep and maintenance, roads, ports, highways, and airports and such things, which the Army Corps of Engineers has said we're trillions of dollars behind. And so there actually is stimulus money already in our economy, but it's poorly spent. It's inefficient from an economic stimulus standpoint. And so I think that I would rather see people like Paul Krugman and others start talking about not just should we spend more, but what are we already spending our money on? And are we really spending in an efficient and cost-effective way? Because there's all sorts of studies that economists have made that show that when you spend money, you know, domestically instead of internationally, and you spend it on infrastructure upkeep and maintenance instead of on things like building weapons and bombs and employing soldiers in other countries, you're going to get more of the multiplier effect. It's going to have a bigger repercussion throughout your economy, and yet we're not getting any of that. And you know, probably in the post-World War II era, when we were the dominant power in the world, we could afford these types of inefficiencies in our economy, because we just, you know, we just economically, militarily, we were so dominant. But now that we live in a much more multipolar, multilateral world, we can't afford these economic inefficiencies anymore. And yet, virtually no one in Washington, D.C. is talking about these things.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who's the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. And we're talking about the cover story in Time magazine just a week ago that predicted the downfall of Europe, the decline and fall of Europe, and in by extension the West. And we're talking about how that simply doesn't stand up to the test of reality in terms of the standard of living in Europe. But what about, though, in terms of the banks? I mean, the bondholders of the banks are the ones in Europe that are getting bailed out. The money that goes to Greece doesn't go to the Greek people. They're expected to tighten their belts. The money goes to the bondholders. And now when they talk about Italy and Spain, the third and fourth biggest economies, being not so much too big to fail but too big to bail, where does it stand in terms of the relationship with the European people and their through their governance system and the bondholders, as opposed to here, where you clearly the taxpayer bailed out Wall Street and got nothing in return? And I mean, effectively, we're in an oligarchy here because the political because of our money politics. There's no question of who runs America now. It's Wall Street. But who runs Europe? Do the bankers still have the same kind of an influence there that they have here?
I don't think so. No, I think in each country that's having debt problems, Greece, Spain, Ireland and Portugal, their situations are not exactly the same. And Greece, it's unfortunately that some ways that Greece has become the poster child of this situation because, you know, Greece really does have problems with spending more than it makes. Spain, on the other hand, in terms of its government, before the economic collapse in 2008, which was a worldwide collapse, Spain's government actually didn't have a deficit. Portugal had a little bit of one. Ireland didn't have a deficit. It's a result of this economic crisis that they didn't cause that has created the problems that they're having. But in a place like Greece, there you have a situation where you've had governments since the late mid-70s when they threw out the last military dictatorship in Greece, governments that have used patronage machines and have used things like devaluing the Greek currency in order to fund that patronage machine, that basically have overspent. And the bill finally came due on them because the lenders finally said, you know what, we're not sure we're going to get paid back by you, and we're not going to lend you any more money unless we charge outrageous rates of interest. So at that point, you know, Greece, I mean, no one's forcing them to borrow more money. They could stop borrowing, but if they did that, then a lot of people who are get their jobs through the government are going to lose a lot of jobs. So it's a fairly delicate situation. To just simply blame it on the banks is just not taking stock of the entire picture in which Greece really has run up a bill that now people aren't willing to lend them money for anymore. And in fact, the people who are lending the money are the other European countries like Germany and France and others who basically have taken Greece off the bond markets. They've given Greece loans at about a 5% interest rate, which is about a third of what Greece would pay if they went out onto the bonds markets and tried to borrow money for the usual way that countries borrow these things. So, and the other thing that I think you have to keep in mind is that they do owe money to Greek and French and British and even U.S. banks. But those are, people have to pay their bills, just like we have to pay our bills at some point. If Greece were to simply say, we're not going to pay you, then no one's going to loan the money anymore, and then they would basically have to start laying off massive amounts of people more than they've already done. So Greece is really in a difficult situation, and it's going to take them quite a few years to get out of that with the help of their fellow European countries who are helping them out. So I don't see that it's just simply a case of blaming the banks in the case of Greece.
Well, it's not a case of blaming the banks because it's clear that in Greece there's a lot of moral hazard in terms of people not paying their taxes. And the last conservative government that ran up all these huge debts, and we know that Goldman Sachs helped them disguise their sovereign debt through all kinds of currency games that were played. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but my sense is that a lot of the European banks are deeply exposed, particularly the German banks, and these bailout packages seem to be to the banks, not to the countries.
Well, they're to the countries to pay off their lenders.
Right.
And if they didn't pay off their lenders, those lenders are not going to lend them any more money, and then they would have to lay off even more people.
Right. So it's the same lenders who owed the money, right?
Right. But, the lenders, the banks in Europe were also looking at the same AAA bond ratings that the credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch's gave to derivatives and credit default swaps that were completely, turns out, to be risky investments, and they had AAA ratings. So a lot of people got stuck as a result of the failure of the regulatory regime that started at Wall Street, started in the United States, and spread around the world. So keep in mind, again, that these banks, these German banks, these French banks, they're holding the deposits of Germans, average everyday Germans, and mom and pop small and medium sized businesses. If they were to go under, it would have repercussions back to Germany. So it's or to France or to Britain or wherever. It's just not simply the case of the banks against the little people. I think it's more complex than that. But I think that ultimately what we're seeing is that Europe is trying to decide how much of a fiscal union or transfer union do we want to be? And these are not easy questions to settle. For example, here in the United States, California, where we all live, they you know, if Alabama or Mississippi run short of money, they can get money from Washington, D.C. that's come from a state like California, which ran surpluses for many years. And in fact, California for decades has been, you know, net transferring money. If you look at the amount of money that in federal taxes that go from Californians to Washington, D.C., and then how much we get back about 70 to 75 cents on the dollar for every dollar we send to Washington, D.C. Well, where does that other 25 cents go? It goes to Mississippi, Alabama, Wyoming, Alaska. A lot of them are red states, and they get that transfer. And so, you know, that's, some people would argue that's a good way for a country, a union, to operate. But you think of it from the point of view of the Germans, and they're thinking, like, wait a minute, do we want to be in this position of California where we're going to be bailing out Greece and Portugal for the next two or three decades? I'm not surprised that they're not just immediately plunging in and saying, yeah, sure, we'll do that, no problem. They're taking their time to think this thing through. So what I'm saying is that these issues are not going to be solved overnight. There's no reason to expect that they should be solved overnight. Europe is in the process of becoming more of a union, of a fiscal and transfer union, but it's going to take time. I would say it's going to take a good 10 years to really for them to settle these issues and figure out how tight of a fiscal and transfer union they want to be. And if you look back at America in 1789, and even before that in 1780 with the Articles of Confederation, we went through a very similar process when we were deciding how much of a union do we want to be. And in fact, it took about 80 years until after the American Civil War for America to really cease being a collection of regions and to become really a nation in many, many ways, politically, economically, and such. So there's no reason to expect that Europe is going to solve these things anytime soon. And the headlines that we're seeing are just simply ideological, patriotic. Americans love to bash Europe, have always loved to bash Europe. I mean, some of the headlines I have in my book, you know, I mean, in fact, I have one that's really quite interesting from November 2006 that was in Newsweek International. And it talks about how the European economy was actually passing the American economy in terms of jobs, growth, all these sorts of things. And yet that article, and that was a cover story in Newsweek International, that article never appeared in Newsweek Domestic because, you know, they don't want Americans to know these sorts of things. So this is just, I think you really can't go by the headlines that we're seeing today. You have to really look at the longer-term trajectory.
Well, just in closing then, Stephen Hill, the North-South divide that is evident now, where it's the northern European countries, particularly Germany, that are bailing out the southern European countries. And clearly the people in Germany are, as you say, are given pause and they're wondering whether this is going to go on forever. And we've had the recent example of Iceland just basically reneging on their debts. Because what happens is the banks loan profitably, and then the countries, as you mentioned earlier, like Ireland, gets stuck with the sovereign debt, or it becomes attached to their sovereign debt. So, just in closing, what's your sense of Germany's long term prospects? Better than ours?
Well, I think that all the developed countries right now are trying to figure out, how do we develop our economies and keep them growing and produce the wealth that we need without relying on these asset bubbles, whether it's stock market, housing, you know, these sorts of unsustainable economies that eventually explode? And how do we do it without hyper-consumerism, because consumerism drives about 70% of the American economy, and yet now in this era of global climate change and pumping carbon into the environment, we know that if our consumerism is too high, it's just going to contribute to more carbon in the environment. So how do we do it, without relying so much on hyper-consumerism? How do we do it in a way that's ecologically sustainable? These are the big challenges that all the countries, developing countries, developed as well as developing countries of the world face. And when you look at it from that point of view, it's just clear to me that Germany, France, Sweden, countries of Europe are doing far more towards really trying to address these issues on multiple levels than we're doing here in the United States. And from the American perspective, it looks like things are falling apart. but in other places around the world, they're in the process of taking stock of this new era, the post-economic crisis, and, you know, economics, ecological sustainability era that we're now in, and saying, how are we going to meet this and preserve our standards of living?
Sure, and not only are we not addressing these issues, we're not even agreeing that they're real. I mean, the Republican leading contender for president, Rick Perry, saying that none of these problems exist, like climate change. So we are definitely going back into a know-nothing kind of Stone Age mentality.
I think one thing I'd say, Ian, is that I think Winston Churchill, if to paraphrase him, he kind of got it right. He said, America always does the right thing after it's done everything else first. And so I think in some ways we're going to come along after other countries figure out what's their best way to go. And, I do think America, we have a lot of strengths, a lot of things that we can rely on in order to move ourselves forward. But right now we are definitely paralyzed and having a hard time figuring out what's the way forward.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, Stephen Hill.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of American Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.